And I'm going to get us started and introduce our speakers. So this evening for our presenters, we have first, probably a pretty familiar face, Jeffrey Blackwell. He is our litigation counsel. He responds to reports of possible violations of the separation between religion and government, works with government officials to find mutually acceptable solutions to potential issues, and manages litigation if issues cannot be resolved amicably. Our next speaker is Andrew Torres. He founded his own firm in 2015 after nearly 20 years of experience in big firms in Baltimore, Washington, and D.C. He represents individuals and businesses in complex civil disputes, including breach of contract and business torts, intellectual property, employment law, insurance coverage, and appeals before various state and federal appellate courts. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School with honors and George Washington University, and he's the co-host of the very popular Opening Arguments podcast, the legal podcast that helps you make sense of the news. Then our final speaker this evening is Carolyn Mala Corbin. She's a professor of law and dean of Distinguished Scholar of the University of Miami School of Law. Her scholarship focuses on First Amendment speech and religion clauses, particularly their intersection with equality issues. Professor Corbin's articles have been published in New York University Law Review, UCLA Law Review, Northwestern University Law Review, Boston University Law Review, and Emory Law Journal, among others, as well as writing for blogs such as SCOTUS Blog, Take Care Blog, ACS Blog. Professor Corbin is a frequent commentator for local and national media on First Amendment questions. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to you all for your discussion.
Great. I think I'm starting. So I am delighted to have this opportunity to speak with you all this evening. We're going to start with June Medical Services versus Russo, the Supreme Court's abortion decision. Now, you may wonder at abortion being included in a program focused on the Supreme Court's separation in church and state cases, but let's be honest, opposition to abortion is generally religiously based, so it actually fits in quite well. At issue in June Medical was the constitutionality of a Louisiana law that required doctors who performed abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. Of course, the real question was whether the Supreme Court was going to eliminate constitutional protection for abortion. It didn't, but to fully understand the significance of June Medical, it's helpful to have some background on abortion jurisprudence. Although most people think that Roe v. Wade is the case that controls abortion law, in fact, current constitutional law is based on later cases, in particular, Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. Planned Parenthood versus Casey was actually another case where it wasn't clear whether the Supreme Court was going to eliminate the constitutional protection for abortion. The Supreme Court reaffirmed in Casey that abortion was protected by the Constitution. At the same time, Casey lowered the level of protection for abortion and consequently held that many abortion regulations were perfectly constitutional. In particular, a regulation would not violate the Constitution unless it imposed an undue burden on women seeking an abortion. And the Supreme Court defined undue burden as the government placing a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion. And fortunately, the court took a very miserly approach to what amounted to substantial obstacles. As far as it was concerned, most regulations did not create substantial obstacles, and therefore the law did not create an undue burden, and it therefore upheld most regulations. Then came Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. And this is sort of the unicorn of abortion decisions. It was quite surprising. At issue were two abortion regulations in Texas, ostensibly to improve women's health, but really designed to make abortion more expensive and more difficult. And one of these laws was identical to the one at issue in June Medical, namely abortion providers had to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. And as a result of these laws, most clinics had to shut down. The number went from 40 to less than 10 in Texas, which is, of course, the goal. So not only did the Supreme Court strike down these laws, but in doing so, they modified the undue burden test. That is, the test that abortion regulations have to pass to be deemed constitutional. In deciding whether a burden was undue or not, courts were now to consider two factors, instead of just one. As before, they must evaluate whether a challenge regulation imposed a substantial obstacle in the path of the woman seeking to end her pregnancy. But in addition, in evaluating whether the law had created an undue burden, the courts also had to consider whether the regulation actually accomplished its stated goal. In other words, if the government were to claim that the regulation was meant to protect women's health, as Texas claimed with its laws, then Texas actually had to provide evidence that the law did in fact promote women's health. And because Texas utterly failed to make that showing, the laws were struck down. So Whole Woman's Health was really such a surprising case because it really strengthened protection for abortion. And then we get to June Medical Services. Again, the case that the Supreme Court decided just this term. And as I mentioned, the law was one identical to the one in Whole Woman's Health, this law about requiring abortion providers to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. And again, as you know, the real issue was whether the Supreme Court was going to hold that abortion was actually protected by the Constitution or not. So the court reaffirmed that abortion was a constitutional right. That's good. That's the good part of the decision. There's also a kind of bad part of the decision because at the same time, it ultimately chipped away at protection by essentially eliminating that extra protection that Whole Woman's Health had provided. And that happened because Chief Justice Roberts was the fifth vote to reaffirm the right to abortion. And so his concurrence was really controlling. And he accurately noted that precedent that the earlier cases required that the court recognize that abortion was a constitutional right and that the admitting privileges law struck down 4 years ago was still unconstitutional. At the same time, Chief Justice Roberts suggested that Whole Woman's Health also deviated from long-established rules and that the court need only consider whether there is a burden on women, not whether the state actually could justify its law. In other words, rather than courts having to ask those two questions, did it create an obstacle, and could the state prove that the law accomplished its stated goal? The case ultimately returns us to the one question, rather anemic rule in Casey. Right? So the bottom line is that abortion is still protected by the Constitution. But at the same time, the standard has been weakened, making it very easy to find abortion regulations constitutional. And that's my hopefully 6-minute summary.
Well, I think I'm up next. I wasn't sure if Samantha was going to cut in and MC it over. Caroline, I think that was an excellent summary of the sort of ups and downs of the case. I'm starting with Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia, which is three consolidated cases. And I want to cut to the punchline. This is an unambiguously good decision, right? There is a concern as to how it overlaps with our interests as atheists. But in my view, that concern shows how how difficult a position we're in the overall context of basically losing the Establishment Clause with the Roberts Supreme Court. And so in that sense, even an unambiguously good decision can be undercut as we move towards a society that the Supreme Court is trying to usher in, that I think is going to be part of the larger overall theme of this discussion, towards taking an accommodationist view of religion and government under the First Amendment. That is an ahistorical view. It is not consistent with 200 years of precedent. I'm sure you'll hear a lot about that from this panel. But let me talk about the case. This is the consolidated set of cases involving the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and specifically whether Title VII, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in employment, whether that specific prohibition also applies to sexual orientation and gender identity. And in a pretty unusual 6-3 lineup, in which joining the court's liberal wing were Chief Justice Roberts and unexpected vote Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court held that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 does in fact prohibit discrimination against individuals on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation as part of that law's prohibition on employment discrimination because of sex. So all three of these cases arose in the same procedural context, which were motions to dismiss by the employer at the trial court level, right? So in other words, you had employees who were fired, who then alleged in their complaint that they were fired for being gay or being trans. And their employers then filed motions to dismiss that said, reserving our rights to say we didn't fire these people for being gay or being trans. Assuming we did, they don't have a legal remedy under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And while it seems, right, for those of you, and I am politically very liberal, this seems like a no-brainer, largely because most of the arguments we hear in opposition to interpreting the Title VII that way are terrible. Let's talk very quickly about some of the terrible arguments, right? This was actually advanced at oral argument. Quote, we're not discriminating on the basis of sex because we treat you the same if you're male and gay and if you're female and gay. Now, that's an incredibly stupid argument as a basis of logic, but it's also one that the Supreme Court, if you just replace sexual orientation with race, roundly has rejected for 6 decades, 5.5 decades, since the Supreme Court's decision in Loving versus Virginia, which prohibited laws against what was called miscegenation or interracial marriage, in which, and I'm not making this up, this is, you know, that recent in our nation's history, the same argument was made, right? It said, look, we're not discriminating on the basis of race. We're saying white people should marry among their own race and black people should marry among their own race. That was a transparently stupid argument in 1967. It's a transparently stupid argument now. That being said, there's a non-trivial argument, and it goes something like this, right? It says the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is almost 60 years old. And over those 6 decades, lots and lots of court decisions have had an opportunity to determine whether sexual orientation or gender identity is included in the Act's terms. And all of those cases up until 2 years ago have said no. And in fact, Congress has repeatedly, for about the past decade, tried to and failed to pass the Equality Act, which would have amended the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and added sexual orientation and in the past couple of years also gender identity to those list of protected classes. And so under ordinary norms of statutory construction, you might say that's a non-trivial argument to the contrary, right? Prior precedent and legislative intent. On the other hand, there's a really, really good argument. There are lots of really good arguments in favor of construing the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as including sexual orientation and gender identity, regardless of what people were thinking when it got passed at the time, right? And that is, I think, really best illustrated by a 1989 case called Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins. And again, this is a case from 1989. So I don't know the average age of our audience, but like, right, I was in high school in 1989, right? Like this is not, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is something I read about in history textbooks, but like 1989, it seems fairly recent to me. Anne Hopkins was an accountant. She worked for what was then Price Waterhouse, which is now PwC, whatever, right? And even back then, even in 1989, they had thousands of accountants, okay? And of the thousands of accountants working for Price Waterhouse, there were 662 partners, of whom 7 were women. That's a little embarrassing. In Anne Hopkins's class, oh, by the way, Anne Hopkins was a rock star accountant, right? Like she brought in tons of, you know, I don't have time to go through all the history, but she was amazing. In her class, there were 88 candidates for partnership, of whom, anyone in the chat want to take a guess how many were women? Yeah, if you guessed one, that would be correct, right? So Anne was the only woman of 88 proposed to become partner. 47 of those 88 were admitted, and as you might imagine from a Supreme Court case, Anne was not one of those 47. And the factual record was really, really important here. I'm going to read just a little bit of it. In rejecting Anne as a partner at Price Waterhouse, she received the following comments. One partner described her as macho. Another suggested she, quote, overcompensated for being a woman. A third advised her to, quote, take a course at charm school. And then finally, I could go on. I trust the bile is at the back of your throat already. The person who cast the deciding vote said, and I quote, Hopkins should, quote, walk more femininely, talk more femininely, dress more femininely, wear makeup, have her hair styled, and wear jewelry, end of quote. 1989. Okay. So, question. Is that, on the basis of the evidence, sufficient to state a claim under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964? If you're not saying yes, I lack the ability to respond to it, right? Like that's clear. That's a core violation of discrimination on the basis of sex. But when you parse it out, think about what the indicia of that violation was, right? It was you're failing to conform to your gender norms, right? You're not feminine enough. You don't have your hair pretty. You don't smile enough. You don't wear enough jewelry. You swear too much, right? Like all of those are sex discrimination on the basis of failure to conform to gender norms. And when you think about people who are gay and trans, that is the ultimate failure to conform to gender norms. And so it's really hard to see how Price Waterhouse can be good law, but failure to extend the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to gay and trans individuals would not be good law. What the Supreme Court did was they crafted a narrow solution that I think in today's day and age is, you know, kind of a throwback to positive decisions that we've seen here and there over the past 2 decades. And that decision it rejected kind of the broad liberal argument that I just made from Price Waterhouse, but also rejected the stare decisis argument, right? And it said, we're just going to look at what the law says, and we are going to apply the traditional legal but-for test. Right. And that is, if you make one fact different, do you get the same result? At which point that's not but for causation, or do you get a different result? at which point it is. Right? And the reason they can do that is because the statute doesn't require an employee to prove that they were only fired because of gender, right? That would be an impossible standard, right? Then I could fire women all day long and I would say, oh yeah, I fired her because she was a woman, but also because I didn't like her, right? Like, and that would be a valid defense if you had to prove only for their gender, right? So you just have to prove that gender is a factor. And the Supreme Court said, there's no way to fire someone for being gay or being trans that doesn't require you to also consider their gender, right? If you fire somebody for sleeping with men and you need to know if they're a man or a woman to figure that out, you're discriminating on the basis of sex, right? If you fire somebody for presenting as a man and they're trans, right? You need to know that is discrimination on the basis of sex. So broad-ranging opinion that I say broad ranging, but very narrowly crafted, designed to cross the ideological spectrum. I want to add one more thing, right? Which is that Gorsuch's majority opinion is incredibly respectful and inclusive. Right. I've read a lot of these cases. I have someone who assists with opening arguments who is trans, and she helps when courts, right, even who are well-meaning, will use language inadvertently, right? Like born biologically male, for example, shows up in several trans opinions. Neil Gorsuch's opinion doesn't use that language, right? It is incredibly respectful and inclusive. And I was awfully surprised by that. So unambiguous, positive decision. Move forward for equality. We can talk about why in the Q&A. But I want to talk about the atheist context in my last 30 seconds here. I know I've probably gone a little long. I apologize. Okay, Caroline, you didn't have to nod that vigorously. Sorry. So what some people are describing as the poison pill is on page 32 of the opinion. And it is just a summary of the state of the law right now, right? And Gorsuch says, this case does not involve a RFRA claim, but worries about how Title VII may intersect with religious liberties are nothing new. And RFRA, quote, operates as a kind of super statute, displacing the normal operation of other federal laws. So it might supersede Title VII in appropriate cases. So the Supreme Court very clearly says, hey, look, if you come back and say, I fired her because she was trans, but also because I'm religious, we're willing to hear that. But there's no way around that under our current state of the law. So it's really bad that our laws are in that place, but Bostock is an unambiguously good decision.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm so used to hearing you at double speed that I had to adjust my mental idea of your voice.
I think I went pretty fast on it.
Well, you did. Thank you. And speaking of women being fired over and over again and not having any recourse to protect their rights, let's move on to Our Lady of Guadalupe v. Morrissey Beru. This was two consolidated cases involving something called the ministerial exception. And right up front, before I get into the details of the cases, let me just really briefly run down what the ministerial exception is. We talked a bit there about Title VII. A number of employment discrimination statutes have carve-outs, and this includes the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title VII, and several others. But those two are relevant to these cases. Those laws have carve-outs that say, if you are a religious employer, you can discriminate on the basis of your religion. So a Catholic school can prefer to hire Catholic teachers. That makes a fair amount of sense. In addition to that, for over a century, I think, the Supreme Court has been pretty conclusive in its statements that the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause prohibit the government, the courts, from adjudicating disputes involving church doctrine and ecclesiastical matters, and particularly church leadership matters. Obviously, directing a religious entity who will be in charge of it is tantamount to an establishment of religion, and also a pretty blatant violation of that organization's free exercise of their religion. All of that makes perfect sense. Over the years, the district and circuit courts around the country handled a number of cases where priests, ministers who had been fired by their churches tried to challenge their firing under anti-discrimination statutes, and the court and were fired where they were fired not for the reason of their religion, for some other reason. And the courts developed what they call the ministerial exception, which essentially says that the courts will not hear anti-discrimination in employment claims involving religious entities as the employer. It wasn't until 2012, in a case called Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School v. EEOC, that the Supreme Court weighed in on whether or not the ministerial exception is a thing. And is a valid interpretation of how these various laws intersect with each other in this context. In that case, well, that case involved a teacher who was diagnosed with narcolepsy, and after a number of months of back and forth with her employer, her name was Parrish, she was fired from her job. And the Supreme Court took up this case. They did not, they confirmed that the ministerial exception is valid and applies in cases involving religious employers. But the question is, what employees does it apply to? And the court said very explicitly, we are not laying out a rigid test for when an employee of a religious entity is a minister or ministerial for these purposes. But in this case, back in 2012, they said these four factors in these factual circumstances, we find dispositive. And those four factors were A, her title. She was a called teacher, meaning she was confirmed by the congregation. She had a multi-year contract. The school also employed lay teachers that were employed by year-to-year contracts and didn't have religious training and things like that. She also had substantial religious training. That was the second factor they considered. Thirdly, she held herself out as a called teacher, as someone who had religious qualifications for the job. And fourth, she served an important religious function in her duties. She taught the students religion and led them in prayer and brought them to mass and those kinds of things. And all four of those things taken together, the court said, we feel she should be considered ministerial, and therefore anti-discrimination statutes don't apply to her position. Now, in this case, in Our Lady of Guadalupe, we're talking about slightly different circumstances. We still have two teachers, this time from two different Catholic schools rather than a Lutheran school. But they were teachers with no substantial religious training. Like, they'd attended some seminars. They didn't have... they weren't called or anything of that sort. The one religious requirement was for one of them, they were required to affirm that they were in good standing with the church. The first case, Our Lady Guadalupe v. Morrissey-Beru, involves a woman named Agnes Morrissey-Beru, who was fired, she alleges, for her age. They fired her because she was too old. And the second was a woman named Kristen Beal, who has since passed away. She was diagnosed with breast cancer, informed her employer, the school, that she would need some time off for treatment. And they basically told her, that's too bad. You won't have a job when you come back, which is a, like, the most straightforward violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act that you can probably possibly conceive of. The court decided that neither of them were entitled to protection under either Title VII or the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was a 7-2 decision. Only Sotomayor and Ginsburg dissented. Sotomayor wrote a dissent, and we'll get to that in a minute. But the entire conservative side of the court, as well as Justices Breyer and Kagan, determined that these positions were ministerial. Now, in the majority opinion, which Justice Alito wrote, Alito basically takes what was his concurrence in Hosanna-Tabor and makes it the majority opinion, essentially saying that the fact that they served some religious function, they taught the students religion, they supervised them in mass, made sure they followed the rules, prayed with them, led them in prayer, that those factors were sufficient. It didn't matter that they didn't have religious titles. It didn't matter that they didn't have religious certification. And specifically, he chastises the lower courts for treating those four factors I talked about a minute ago as sort of a checklist. And in his defense, the court did say, this is not a rigid test. It explicitly said that. Nevertheless, when they immediately go through and lay out four factors, that's what the lower courts do. They look at the factors that the Supreme Court lays out and says, do these apply? No? Okay. But Alito chastised them for doing that and I want to include this little bit of language from his opinion. When a school with a religious mission entrusts a teacher with the responsibility of educating and forming students in the faith, judicial intervention into disputes between the school and the teacher threatens the school's independence in a way that the First Amendment does not allow. Now, even after chastising the lower courts for treating the four factors in Hosanna-Tabor as a rigid test, what Alito does is essentially take one factor of those four and say, this is the test, while all the time saying there's no rigid test, and then proceeds to say that basically all teachers at religious schools are ministers at this point. I can't conceive of a situation where a teacher at a religious school now is not considered a minister and therefore totally unprotected by federal non-discrimination statutes. Interestingly, and Sotomayor talks about this, but one of the teachers in her like employee handbook, it said, you will not be, you know, we do not discriminate on the basis of age, disability, all the various things. And yet still they say, no, you're a minister. So actually we do, despite that we explicitly told you that we don't. Thomas wrote a concurrence in this, in which he essentially says that we shouldn't even really be delving too deeply into the function that the employee serves. He says that the courts should, quote, defer to religious organizations' good faith claims that a certain employee's position is ministerial. How are courts supposed to determine if a claim that a position is ministerial is made in good faith? I have no idea. But that's what he argues the test should be. Now, let's talk about Sotomayor's dissent, because Sotomayor, in her dissent, I think is entirely on point. First off, she points out that Hosanna-Tabor declined to adopt a rigid formula for deciding when an employee qualifies as a minister, and points out that now the court says that essentially all school teachers are ministers, so I guess it doesn't matter. And then I just want to read you two passages because they are very descriptive of the situation. Quote, pause for a moment on the court's conclusion. Even if the teachers were not Catholic, And even if they were forbidden to participate in the church's sacramental worship, because they aren't Catholic, they would nonetheless be ministers of the Catholic faith simply because of their supervisory role over students in a religious school. That stretches the law and logic past their breaking points. And I think she is precisely right. She goes on, she concludes the opinion with this. Recently, this court has lamented a perceived discrimination against religion, citing explicitly Espinoza, which we'll get to later in our conversation. Yet here it swings the pendulum in the extreme opposite direction, permitting religious entities to discriminate widely and with impunity for reasons wholly divorced from religious beliefs. The inherent injustice in the court's conclusion will be impossible to ignore for long, particularly in a pluralistic society like ours. One must hope that a decision deft enough to remold Hosanna Tabor to fit the result reached today reflects the court's capacity to cabin the consequences tomorrow. I respectfully dissent. She's exactly right. I'm glad that Ginsburg joined her. I don't know why several other justices didn't. It's something of a mystery to me. I'm very curious what Breyer and Kagan's thinking is in this area. But this case has some vast ramifications. And I'm noting that we've only gone through three cases and it's already 8:45. So really quickly, the ramifications for this are serious. First of all, there's no logic that I can see that limits this to just religious schools. If you're a nurse employed at a religious hospital, do anti-discrimination statutes apply to you? Under this, I don't think they do, because you're core to the mission of the, you know, religious entity. And once you've extended it to hospitals, in light of the court's decision in Hobby Lobby way back in 2014, does it apply to religiously minded, closely held for-profit corporations? Because based on the reasoning in Hobby Lobby, I'm not sure how you prevent it from extending there. And with those two scary ramifications out of the way, I will pass it back off to Andrew to talk about Little Sisters of the Poor.
Well, Hobby Lobby is a great transition to Little Sisters of the Poor.
Indeed.
I'm gonna try and blaze through this in a lightning round. This is a terrible decision. This is a 7-2. I'm gonna talk about where we get there, but essentially, as we're sketching the larger picture of the Supreme Court, we have the Supreme Court's conservative wing, which includes Justice Roberts, who do not buy into nonsense puff pieces in Newsweek calling him a new centrist or what have you. If you're down on that, just pull up his dissent in Obergefell, which was the gay marriage decision in 2014. So the five justice conservative majority are hard accommodationists, and accommodationists doesn't go far enough. They envision an America in which the First Amendment means that the government may prefer religion to irreligion, right, to atheism, but it may not establish a church. It may not prefer among branches of Christianity. And that's essentially the only restriction that I can divine out of the five justice conservative majority on religious issues. Joining them on a majority of religious cases over the past 5 years are Justices Breyer and Kagan, who I would call soft accommodationists. So when you see a case that's 7-2, like Trinity Lutheran, that leaves only Sotomayor and Ginsburg as upholding what I would call the traditional view of the First Amendment. Now, how does that play out? That plays out very, very clearly with respect to the Affordable Care Act. When Obamacare was passed, one of the fundamental principles was that employers would be required, that covered employers, right, that were subject to the law, had to make available to their employees a group health plan or health insurance coverage that would provide certain minimum essential coverages. And among those minimum essential coverages were preventative health services. And as part of a way of holding off health care lobbyists, lobbyists from the insurance industry. That provision required that preventative health services be offered without cost sharing, i.e. without co-pays or deductibles, right? So your employer has got to have a minimum plan. That minimum plan can suck, but at least it's got to offer you preventative medicine. And then something really impressive happened in the U.S. Senate, which was, despite having only three women senators at the time, the women senators got together and said, you know, this definition of preventative health services excludes the most important preventative health services for women. And so they passed my senator, Senator Barbara Mikulski, the senator of many of us here on this call, passed the Women's Health Amendment that said, in order to promote equality in women's access to health care, counter gender-based discrimination and disparities in access, that the preventative health care services required preventative care and screenings, again, without cost-sharing requirements. And that became the law. Okay, so unambiguous, good thing, Obamacare now covers preventative care for both men and women. And yes, for women, that includes birth control. That was not explicit in Obamacare, but became explicit in the implementing regulations. And I would argue is explicit in the text, but you know, I guess Sam Alito would probably contest that. But in any event, that's what the ACA requires. And as you probably know, and as Jeff alluded to, from the beginning, that provoked howls from the religious right, who said, we don't want our churches to have to offer health care to women that would include access to reproductive, to birth control. This is an unbelievably stupid argument, and I do not understand why at the Supreme Court, nobody has said, isn't this argument a justification for not paying women if you're a church, right? Because they can take your perfectly fine money and go out and buy dirty, dirty birth control with it. Nobody has articulated a constitutional reason why providing access to a healthcare plan that provides the option for women to buy birth control is any more of a direct link to a violation of your religious rights than paying them with money that you can then use to buy birth control. I can't figure it out. But churches started howling. And because things weren't that great for atheists, even under Obama, I mean, better than now, but still not great, the Obama Department of Health and Human Services began crafting exemptions for religious organizations. In 2011, so ACA passes 2010, 2011, HHS starts to craft a religious exemption. That was a four-part test. I'm not going to go through it because I've already gone over time. But the fourth part required the entity to be, quote, a church, integrated auxiliary, convention or association of churches, or the, quote, exclusively religious activities of any religious order, end of quote. So in other words, you had to be a church. That was supposed to accommodate the religious right. But as you know, you give them a centimeter and they will take an astronomical unit. And they did so. They not only lobbied HHS to add religiously aligned nonprofit organizations, so focus on the family and the like, but skipping over a whole lot of history, Hobby Lobby sued. Now, you may know Hobby Lobby as a store that is a purveyor of crap. Okay, they are a dollar store that sells to Midwestern scrapbookers. Okay, my wife is a scrapbooker, so I'm not. I can make that insult. They sell garbage, and for some reason, Hobby Lobby, which is a privately held corporation, argued with a straight face, and nobody like threw things at their counsel, the Alliance Defending Freedom, when they said that Hobby Lobby possesses religious views. That makes no sense. A corporation is a profit center. Hobby Lobby does not accept prayers as payment. They accept dollars as payment. They do not dispense religious advice. They dispense crap. But nevertheless, the Supreme Court in 2014 ruled that for-profit companies have religious beliefs and therefore are entitled to an exception under the Affordable Care Act. Then there's parallel litigation in 2016 involving Little Sisters that I'm going to skip over for time. We'll talk about it in the Q&A. But you all know what happened in 2016. 46% of this country lost their goddamn minds, elected Donald Trump. And so in 2017, Trump's Department of HHS promulgated new rules that basically took the Hobby Lobby decision and codified it into the ACA as part of the administrative rules interpreting that put into effect a quote moral exemption for employers, including privately held for-profit companies that have quote sincerely held moral objections to providing some or all forms of contraceptive coverage. Pennsylvania and New Jersey sued to block the implementation of that rule. They were correct above and beyond. They were correct for two reasons. Number one, because the statutes does not provide for exceptions. And so therefore, there was no delegation of that authority to Health and Human Services to craft an exception in the first place. The exception for religious organizations is required by the First Amendment and thus does not require such delegation. But the rest of the law does not give that executive agency the power to add that exception. Seven votes on the Supreme Court don't care about that argument, nor do they care about the fact that this Trump HHS rule, like virtually every Trump era administrative ruling, was blatantly in violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. They did not provide the appropriate notice. They did not provide the appropriate comment period. They didn't follow the rules. I could get into that, but you don't really care about that. And the Supreme Court didn't care. A five vote from the hard right majority said, this is perfectly fine. And then there was a very narrow Breyer and Kagan concurrence that attempted to graft on an aspect of deference to administrative decisions. It's called Chevron deference. I definitely don't have time to get into that here. That falls under the nice try, Justice Breyer, but it does not form a part of the majority holding, will not stop this court from selectively using it where it finds appropriate. But this continues to be sort of a part of the puzzling voyages of Justice Breyer in terms of figuring out what he thinks the First Amendment means. I will remind you as I end this that Justice Breyer was the deciding vote in two Ten Commandments monuments cases that were literally decided on the same day. Van Orden versus Perry in Texas, which upheld the Ten Commandments monument, and McCreary County versus ACLU in Kentucky, which struck down the Ten Commandments monument. And I think lawyers smarter than I am on all sides of the political spectrum have struggled in vain to figure out what the hell Justice Breyer is thinking in First Amendment cases. This case continues that giant question mark, but there you go. How was that for double speed, Jeff?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Caroline, go ahead.
Okay. So I am now going to talk to you about Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. And Espinoza is about government funding of private religious schools. So here's the background. The state of Montana created a tax credit program where for every $1 that you donated to a school scholarship organization, you would get $1 off your tax bill. And then the school scholarship program would provide scholarship for students at private schools. Here's the problem. 12 of the 13 participating private school and the one sort of organization that was created were religious schools. Actually, they were Christian schools. And the Montana Constitution bans the state of Montana from funding either directly or indirectly, any religious schools. So mindful of that provision, often termed a no aid provision, mindful of that provision in the Montana Constitution, the Montana Department of Revenue, which was administering this program, created a rule that private religious schools could not participate. Parents of children at a private religious school sued, arguing that the rule excluding religious schools violated their religious liberty rights under the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. The Montana Supreme Court looked at this whole issue and struck the whole scholarship program down, citing the no aid provision. So the end result was that no Montana money was going to any private school, religious or secular. Nonetheless, the parents of the children at the private religious school claimed discrimination, and the Supreme Court agreed. So the Supreme Court held that if the government wanted to fund private schools, it must make taxpayer dollars, your money and my money, equally available to religious schools. And the court was building on its problematic decision from a few years earlier in Trinity Lutheran Church versus Comer. In that case, the Supreme Court held that a state violated the Free Exercise Clause when it created a program, in this case, a program to subsidize playgrounds, but then excluded religious school playgrounds solely because of their status as a religious institution. The Supreme Court said, if the state creates a benefit program, it cannot exclude an organization just because it's linked to a church. That's penalizing the church and unconstitutional discrimination against religion. And then in Espinoza, the Supreme Court said the same kind of discrimination was happening in Montana. The state had created a program to subsidize private education, but then excluded religious schools solely because of their status as religious institutions. In both cases, the exclusion, according to the court, was an unconstitutional penalty on religion and violated the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause. There are so many problems with this decision. I'm going to highlight just a couple of them. One's a little more legal than the other. The first, more legal argument, is Montana's funding scheme is very easy to distinguish from the whole playground program. Right? This is the Montana scholarship program was not like the program in Trinity Lutheran Church, where secular school playgrounds got money, but religious school playgrounds did not get money. In this case, nobody got any money, right? So if nobody's getting any money, there's no discrimination. It's not like the secular organization is getting something. The religious organization is not getting, because nobody is getting anything. And if there's no discrimination against religious entities, there really is no free exercise issue. So that's one very easy way to distinguish the private school program from the playground. Furthermore, according to the Supreme Court in Trinity Lutheran, the government, you could argue, I think it's debatable, but at least they claimed that in the playground program, the money was being used for secular purposes, namely improving playgrounds and making them safer for kids. In the Montana case, there's no limit on what the money is used for. So even assuming that they were favoring private secular schools over private religious schools, the cases are not the same. In Trinity Lutheran, the state's money was used for secular reasons. Here, the state's money can be used for religious indoctrination. And so even their legal argument is sort of tenuous. But of course, the bigger problem, the real problem, the trend that we're seeing again and again in these cases is the complete evisceration of the Establishment Clause. The idea that any disfavoring of religion automatically violates the free exercise clause is simply ludicrous, right? For better or for worse, religion is special in the United States. It gets distinctive treatment. It gets a lot of special advantages, like the ministerial exemption from anti-discrimination law that we just heard about. Religious schools can discriminate with impunity against their religious teachers. They are not answerable to answer at anti-discrimination law. But at the same time that they are subject to special benefits, they should be subject to special limits, like they are not eligible to get cash from the government. After all, we're supposed to have an establishment clause as well as a free exercise clause. But under the Supreme Court, right, it acts like there is no establishment clause. There is no long history of not funding religious organizations for a whole host of reasons. So the state we find now is that private religious schools can both get our money and they also have the constitutional right to discriminate against their teachers with that money, right? So we'll I think I see the trend where it's become very easy to cry religious discrimination and claim violations of the free exercise clause. It's almost impossible to make a claim that the establishment clause has been violated. So unfortunately, I think this case very much continues the trend of really enlarging protection for religious organizations and a really expansive understanding of what counts as discrimination, and really just chopping away at the establishment clause.
Thank you, Caroline. And that segues us nicely into the case I want to talk about from that will be coming up next term that I want to make sure is on everyone's radar, Fulton v. City of Philadelphia. I'm going to run through this super fast. Catholic Social Services provides, is among one of like 30 agencies, private agencies that provide foster care in the City of Philadelphia. They provide those by virtue of a contract with the city. That contract includes a provision that the providers have to abide by the by Philadelphia's Fair Practices Ordinance, which includes a requirement that they not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. The city learned that Catholic Social Services, CSS, was discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation, not even not even considering LGBTQ couples as potential parents. They just immediately would refer them to other agencies. That's in violation of their contract with the city. The city did not renew that contract after they learned that CSS was discriminating. They had some conversations with CSS where they tried to reach some sort of agreement. Those failed, and the city did not renew the contract. As a result, CSS and a number of foster parents who foster through CSS sued the city. They sought a preliminary injunction to have the city essentially reinstate and renew the contract and not require CSS to abide by the city's non-discrimination ordinance. They were denied that preliminary injunction. They appealed it up to the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit, in a very well-reasoned opinion, says, no, you're not entitled to a preliminary injunction. It doesn't look like you're going to win this one. They appealed it up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has agreed to hear that next term. They haven't set an argument date. There is concern that this case is primed to overturn a case from 1993 called, it was 1991, I'm blanking now, but Employment Division v. Smith. And Employment Division v. Smith laid out a very basic test that says, if a law is of general applicability and religiously neutral, then it's not a violation of the Free Exercise Clause. In response to that test, Congress passed RFRA, and then when RFRA when the court determined that RFRA didn't apply to the states, a bunch of states also passed their own versions of RFRA that says if some government act burdens your, is a substantial burden on your religious exercise, it must be narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling government interest. That's called the strict scrutiny test. The Third Circuit said, hey, look, even if Smith, you know, even if this isn't a general law of a neutral law of general applicability, it still meets strict scrutiny because the city has a compelling interest in protecting its citizens against discrimination. That's been said for a long time. So, no, you don't win. The CSS and the parents are trying to get the Supreme Court essentially to say otherwise. And this could have some very far-reaching ramifications for the future. And I'm trying to think if there are any other key things that I really want to throw in before we hand it over to questions, because I really want to get to questions. Let's see. So they make, really quickly, they make two arguments. According to them, RFRA has not resulted in a flood of litigation of people trying to get exemptions from generally applicable laws. That's not true. There have been a bunch of laws or a bunch of lawsuits involving RFRA. Also, according to the petitioners, the CSS, Smith is counter to the text and history of the First Amendment. This is also not true. The text of the First Amendment explicitly favors a broad reading of the Establishment Clause and a narrow reading of the Free Exercise Clause. The Supreme Court, despite the textualists or originalists on the Supreme Court, has read it the other way around, and I think that's pretty blatantly wrong, but we can get into that later. And I'll leave it at that. And Sam, questions? Only 20 minutes
past really where quick. We want to breathe. You're good. We have a ton of really good questions, so I will try to do what I usually do, which is sort of consolidate a few of them. So there is a fair number of questions, as you might expect, in comments in the chat, talking about, you know, the last few rulings have been 7-2, and that's very concerning. And is there anything that we can do about that? People are sort of discussing what we can do legislatively, what we can do politically, or if there's just nothing we can do and we have to be very careful of cases we take and have some strategy behind what we do.
Vote.
People also want to know if you're personally disappointed in Breyer and Kagan and any of their rulings.
I want to jump in real quick on Breyer and Kagan, because part of me wonders if, you know, because even with their votes, it would be a 5-4 decision and make no difference. You know, if there was another either accommodationist or strict separationist on the court, if they might hew more toward that side of things, who knows? Just throwing that out there. My attempt at a defense of the indefensible.
How about you, Andrew and Carolyn? Do you have anything to add?
Carolyn?
No.
Yeah.
the part of the courts has been the end goal of the Federal Society, of which many of you may be familiar with. There is a liberal counterpart, which is the American Constitution Society. So to the extent you're interested in questions about the courts, that might be an organization that would also interest you.
Yeah, that's a great plug. The resources are very, very different, right? I love ACS, I sincerely doubt that the head of ACS will get carte blanche to pick Joe Biden's Supreme Court nominees in a year's time. So It's bad. I mean, the reason I don't have anything to add to what Jeff said is it's bad, and without a massive overhaul of the courts that is beyond the scope of this discussion, it's going to be bad for a long time, right? And this will not be the first time in our nation's history where you will have multiple decades of the judiciary being out of step with the rest of the country.
And logic and reason.
And logic and reason, yeah.
So there's some other questions about the dangers of the literalist interpretation of Title VII.
Yeah, so let me speak to that real quickly, because part of what made Bostock such an interesting decision is it ordinarily, for those of us on the left, like yours truly, we kind of lump together all of the court's right wing as being, quote, originalists, right? But they're actually sort of multiple like the whole judicial philosophy is at odds with the mainstream view of jurisprudence that has held sway for the past 100 years, both liberal and conservative. It is a project of right-wing activism, but they're different flavors within that kind of overarching umbrella. And this court highlighted the Bostock decision highlighted the difference between Gorsuch's subflavor, which is called textualism, which says the statute means what the plain meaning of the words say, versus Alito's version, which is originalism, which is the statute means what the people who wrote it thought the plain meaning of the words were.
Well, what he thought the people
I mean, look, like one of the reasons the whole enterprise is bankrupt is that lawyers are super good at lots of things. But one of the things we suck at is history, right? Like, I don't know about either of you, but like I had two history classes in college, and one of them was like one of those 300-person lecture hall, right? Like, I am manifestly not qualified to tell you what the common definition of the word discrimination in 1964 or the common definition of anything in 1789 was. So, you know, in practice, those philosophies tend to be, and here's the game, and I saw that this was, I'm going to sneak ahead because I saw that this was also a question in the chat window. What any flavor of originalism allows you to do is ignore stare decisis, to say, I don't care what the Supreme Court has said for the past two centuries. If I can come up with an interpretation of what the law or this constitutional provision means, then I get to add that in de novo, kind of regardless. And sort of the master class in that were the Supreme Court's gun cases, right? DC versus Heller and McDonald versus Chicago, in which Antonin Scalia just invented out of whole cloth a reinterpretation of the Second Amendment that was at odds with literally 200 years of jurisprudence. So that's the game. But actually,
I'm going to just jump in and say it's even worse than that, because what they're trying to argue is that this decision is not, I'm not imposing my own values. I'm only trying to uncover what was historically understood, what this provision was historically understood to mean. But of course, there is no agreed upon history. There's no agreed upon understanding of what a particular provision means. It's often controversial right from the founding. So what it allows them to do is to impose their own values at the same time claiming that they're not imposing their own values because they're just uncovering what it truly means.
Yep.
It's a very
100%.
Religious connotations there are amazing. Yeah. I want to real briefly, originalism, there's a quote on the wall of the portico of the Jefferson Memorial that has a quote from him that says, "I'm not an advocate for frequent changes in laws and constitutions, but laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, new truths discovered, and manners and opinions change, with the change of circumstances, institutions must advance also to keep pace with the times. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him when a boy, as a civilized society, to remain ever under the regimen of their barbarous ancestors." So Jefferson was not an originalist either.
Yeah. No, and let me amplify that. There was a comment from Bonnie. I'm sorry, you know, to try and rein back on the lawyer speak. Sorry, we're doing our best here.
I was about to say something. Can you define some of those things?
but yeah, so let me try and make what Jeff said kind of translate a little bit from legalese into English.
It is your job, after all, on a whole podcast, right?
I do my best. It is internally contradictory and inconsistent to say that we ought to interpret the Constitution in the lens of what the founding fathers thought particular constitutional provisions meant, because the founding fathers themselves did not intend for us to interpret the Constitution that way. And so you wind up with an instant contradiction of, oh, okay, let's follow what the founding fathers thought this meant. They thought it meant that we were enshrining principles into law that would develop over time, as Jeff just so eloquently read from the side of the Jefferson Memorial. So the points to take away. Caroline just outlined how originalism is the enterprise of right-wing activism. It allows them to disguise value-laden conservative outcome propositions as being neutral, just calling balls and strikes. It isn't. And Jeff points out that it is also intellectually bankrupt, even if you don't care about the fact that it results in conservative outcomes. So hopefully, Bonnie, that's a bit of translation into English for you. We're trying. We got to geek out here, man.
We've got to. The three of us may have to do like a Zoom happy hour or something just to like get it all out.
I have a liquor cabinet very, very close to this desk, so.
Can we have another question?
Yep, let's get back into Q&A here. We have a whole bunch of questions related to how do you change the composition of the court. And it's a question that I've asked on other panels of similar natures, full of attorneys, because it comes up every time. How about expanding the bench? So essentially packing the court, and are you for it, against it? What do you see as problematic about that or a good thing about that? And probably each of you could take just like 2 minutes, though, shorter response.
I'll pass because I answered this question when I was talking with Jay Wexler, so I'll let the two of them take some time. There you go.
Caroline, you want to go first?
You know, I'm sort of torn. And obviously, right now, if we have a Democratic president, I would love to expand the Supreme Court and pack it with people who are not, who are more aligned with mainstream America. Any kind of plan that you, and any kind of changes that you make, it can cut both ways. It might work for you at one time and then not work for you when you're not in power. So I think the answer is really, we need to be in power. and if we are in power, then we can pick the kind of judges that we think would make more just decisions. So I tend towards that path, I think.
Yeah, I started off where Caroline is, you know, sort of being wary about it, and I have come to the conclusion that we need a Judiciary Act of 2021 in the event that Democrats retake the Congress, retake the Senate, and elect the Joe Biden president. Donald Trump has, in 3.5 years, thanks to Mitch McConnell's shenanigans, now appointed. And we talk about the Supreme Court. It is more
not
crucial. Yeah, that he has appointed as many judges, roughly speaking, as United States District Court judges, for life, and United States Court of Appeals judges for the various circuits, as Obama and Bush did in 8 years. Okay, so the right wing hijacked a whole bunch of Obama's appointments. They gave them to Trump. He has taken those appointments and given them to Federalist Society ideologues, often woefully unqualified Federalist Society ideologues. Those of you who listen to opening arguments know that the guy whose only credentials are getting his ass kicked in a debate by me is now on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He's 38 years old. He has never argued a motion in court, and he is now a heartbeat away. That is the feeder court to the Supreme Court. That's Merrick Garland's court. So the judiciary is in a super bad way. I could talk about this in more depth. We don't have the time. I would recommend, there was a Law Review article, for those of you who dig this sort of stuff, that is called Asymmetric Constitutional Hardball, by, Joseph Fishkin and David Posen. It's from 2018. And, essentially the thesis is that, when you think about, the things that are sort of technically legal, but against conventions, right? Let me give you a great example of that. Mitch McConnell stealing a Supreme Court seat, right? Saying, we're just not going to hold hearings. There was nothing to stop it. Like, we couldn't get mandamus to force him to hold a hearing, but it's never been done in the history of the Republic. Those are the kinds of things that are considered constitutional hardball, and rigorous statistical analysis proves that Republicans do that way more often than Democrats do, right? So it's not a, both sides, when we get in power, we're suckers and we're stupid, and we put the most qualified people on the bench, regardless of whether they're 50 or 60 or 70. When Republicans get in power, they take their ideologues who are 38 years old and pack the bench with these people. It's time to fight back. I don't like that. I think it's disastrous for the long-term future of the Republic, but I think the only thing worse than that is letting them walk all over us, right? A sort of tit for tat strategy if you're thinking about, games theory. So.
Excellent. So keeping in mind that some of our panel and American Atheists are 501c3, and so we have to remain nonpartisan in the elections. You guys don't, because you're our guests, but we do. And we have a lot of folks who are commenting about what do we do now, right? We all talk about the fact that the atheists and non-believers are a growing political force, and that we should be a block of power that people should be paying attention to as we grow. And there's a whole bunch of comments about basically us needing to get off our ass and get out there and do things. So what would that look like in your opinion? Clearly we have our own opinion at American Atheists about what we want our volunteers and groups to do, but curious what your take on that might be. I'm going to toss it to Caroline, please, if you have some ideas.
I think I'm going to say again, it's about getting into positions of power. And so what do you need to do to get that power? It's not just the federal bench. There's also the state bench. It's not just national elections. It's local elections. It's not just voting. It's running for things so that you yourself are in the position. I think there are lots of ways to be politically active, and you should find the one that suits you. You could be going to protests, you could be writing letters, you could be registering people to vote, you could be donating money, you could be working with a particular organization and helping them raise money. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to participate.
Yeah, as I want to say, get out there and do the things. Whatever they are, right? Get out there and do them. Andrew, do you have something you want to add?
Yeah, I love everything Caroline just said. And I would add that I think the way in which you craft long-term power is by building grassroots movements from the bottom up, right? Starting at the local and state level. And you see in the last cycle, in this election cycle, a number of openly atheist candidates who are running for state legislature positions and who are organizing in their communities. And one of the frustrations that I have in the political process are the folks that want to start at the top. If you think, and so let's put this in expressly legal terms. If you think the federal judiciary may be lost as an instrument of progressive change and may be an implement of regressive tactics for the next 30 years, there's a surefire way around that. And that is state constitutional provisions can supplant and exceed federal constitutional protections, right? So there is nothing to stop a state from adding more protections as a matter of law when the Supreme Court falls down on the job. And having an institutional structure in place, even in, you know, deep red states, even in Montana, right, even in Oklahoma, like, get out there, do where, like, I did a live show in Salt Lake City, and like Salt Lake City is one of the most progressive places I've ever been. Like I loved it there. Like you wouldn't, you know, lots of us, you know, liberal left coast elite types. There are plenty of opportunities there. And I would say, start by working in your neighborhood.
I'll just add, you know, engage with your elected officials, like everybody has said. And when you do so publicly, do so at town halls, do so on social media. When you do it on social media, tag it Atheists Engage. Let us know that you're doing it. Screenshot that you're doing it. Because if they censor you when you do it, we might be able to sue them for that. we have to exercise and defend our rights. Be it voting or speaking, what have you. But most importantly, let our government know how sizable a community we have. And that means you have to speak on behalf of a lot of people who are scared to do so, or, you know, legitimately or not. Atheistengage.org.
So I'm going to add, that was a great segue. Thank you. Because I was about to mention the fact that we have a ton of these programs that we have recorded in the past. One of them is Jeff talking about Atheists Engage to the Secular Student Alliance a few weeks ago. But we also have a bunch of resources and tools on state legislative activity and advocacy that you can do as a local group or a local person. And also a bunch of information on the state of the secular states, which is a report that we put together that sort of rates what your state looks like on the laws that we are tracking that are both positive laws and negative laws. And all of those can be found at atheist.org/webinars. And there is recordings of all of them there. So those are some good resources from us. And of course, there are other good resources out there, but definitely get out there and do the things. So we are just about out of time. I wanted to give you each just like 1 minute to wrap up and see if there's anything that you didn't touch on that you think, oh gosh, I should have said that, and then we'll be done for the evening.
I yield my time to Caroline.
Also, good time to let us know what you're doing out in the world, and if there's anything that we should, as I mentioned earlier, there'll be a follow-up email to all of our participants. So if there's anything that you want to promote coming up, go ahead and feel free.
I want to say that I'm also a member of the Humanist Legal Society. So for those of you out there who are lawyers, you might be interested in joining us, part of the American Humanist Association. And we're also doing a Supreme Court roundup. So if you love Supreme Court roundups, there'll be another one August 12th. So look for that information and by all means join us.
And maybe they'll go over time on the cases that we didn't go over time on. And, you know, you'll get a balanced, you know, well-rounded view of everything.
I want to forward to everyone here, like Jeff's original email, which was like, here are the 13 cases we could go
over. Our 3-hour webinar.
Yeah.
We could always do part two. But for this evening, we are about at time. And so I just want to mention a couple of things that we have upcoming. We have our Summer Secret Speaker Series continues next week with Seth Andrews joining Nick Fish. And they're going to be talking about why the atheist movement needs good storytellers. I imagine that it is going to be a really great 90-minute program as well. And as usual, we won't get to all your questions, and I apologize in advance. You can find the registration for that at atheist.org/Seth Andrews. And you can register for that now. The link is up and live. We will have some more coming up in the month of August, and then we'll be continuing the series once a month after that. We obviously will have to change the name. It won't be summer anymore, right? It's almost over. So with that, I am going to bid you all good evening. Thank you once again to Caroline and to Andrew, and of course to Jeff. You guys were wonderful speakers. We're getting
a ton of really
great feedback in the chat.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming. I guess I'll throw in at the end.